Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And happy Easter to everybody.
Hey, how
about that? I read a joke about where chocolate eggs come from, but I can't remember the answer, the punchline.
Well,
we're not talking about that
anymore.
That's
a big help. Well, our rabbit is back, you know. The rabbit that sometimes comes in our garden.
Oh, is that?
Yeah,
really?
He's been back for several weeks. I mean, he must have gotten the drop on Easter.
Well, yeah, but he only has chives to eat. That's the day chives.
Yeah, he was eating some weeds too. He was trying to be helpful.
Good.
Anyway, let's get on with today's program.
Okay, today's program is we're going to take three different opinions or perspectives. I guess it is.
Perspectives is the right way of describing it.
Yeah, on food. Starting with somebody who has probably one of the best jobs in the world, running the test kitchens for Williams-Sonoma, getting to travel all over the world. Oh, boy, what a job that is.
But there was a downside. She discovered that she was suffering from
rheumatoid arthritis.
Yeah, and inflammation generally throughout her body. And she discovered that it was as a result of the foods she was eating. So she decided she would share her views as to what it is that she has found gives her a diet that is not only acceptable from a nutritional standpoint, but also helps to take care of this problem, which apparently must be more common than we
it
think.
It is very common. But at any rate, the book is called The Anti-Inflammation Cookbook, Delicious Ways to Reduce Inflammation and Stay Healthy. And we're going to be talking with the author, Amanda Haas. You know, I think I've just discovered my new best friend, Amanda Haas. yes, I mean, we're really talking about your new book, The Anti-Inflammation Cookbook, Delicious Way to Reduce Inflammation and Stay Healthy, which you did in conjunction with Dr. Bradley Jacobs. It's something we don't usually get into because any kind of health and medical stuff isn't really our area of expertise. But this looked like a solid book, I mean, solid facts, and also the recipes are delicious looking.
Oh, thank you.
But you have a backstory, and so does Dr. Jacobs. I mean, yours is that you were sick, but you didn't have a diagnosis until you found out you had rheumatoid arthritis.
Yeah, I was showing symptoms of rheumatoid arthritis, even though I tested negative for it. And so,
yeah, a lot of times that happens. I don't know why.
I know. I'd gotten a virus that was kind of latching onto me like RA. And so it was amazing after all of these traditional and non-traditional treatments I'd tried that food wound up being the best thing for me.
Yeah, but you have a food career. In fact, you have an enviable job at Williams-Sonoma.
Right. So, believe it or not, when I realized that foods were kind of part of my problem and that gluten was causing a lot of my pain and that it really could be my best tool for feeling better, I was afraid to tell everybody because I cook and eat for a living. So
I
had to get over
that. Yeah.
Yeah.
But so the genesis of this book is your own backstory, and you found a similar-minded, like-minded, holistic a physician who can help you with it, with
exactly.
The facts. But you made all the recipes.
Yeah, and so the publisher was smart enough to understand that, you know, I'd kind of put this hypothesis out there that food was making me feel lousy, but it could also make me feel great if I figured out what I could eat. And they found the doctor for me, and he was just the most amazing fit in that he's East meets West as well, and really explained to me and dug deep with me to figure out why food was making me feel lousy and then how I could turn it around.
But is it all about inflammation? And what actually gets... I mean, as I said, I'm not a doctor, a medical person.
Yeah, I mean, what gets inflamed?
Yes, that's what I mean.
It's so funny, but everything in your body can be inflamed. And, you know, when people even say, what is inflammation? It's the body's response to outside irritants, right? So even if you cut your finger and you see it swell up and it starts to heal, like, there are good times to be inflamed. You know, it's also the healing process for us. But when you begin to have chronic inflammation in your body that could be anything from heartburn to muscle spasms to, you know, different forms of things on your skin, that's when it becomes a problem. So for me, I realized everything that an allergist pointed out to me, all of these back problems I was having, whether it was my back pain or indigestion or chronic heartburn and stomach problems, they were all simply different forms of inflammation, and I needed to figure out what foods could work for me to help and what was making me feel so awful.
So it wasn't just the food processing part of your system that was reacting badly. It was other things as well.
Correct. And so, like, I found out along the way, too, that dairy and I don't agree, which a lot of people find. But so, yeah, it was, you know, the refined stuff never really probably makes any of us feel well. But I just had a real allergy to wheat and then the dairy, I figured out. And the more I started messing around with my diet, the more empowered I became to kind of change what I was eating.
Now, for those people who will remember only a little bit of this conversation and may not buy your book, you've mentioned some of the really bad things, or the things that have bad effects, like sugars, which you just mentioned.
Right.
And dairy and the gluten in wheat. Are there some others that are things you should be real suspicious of?
Yeah, I think anything that's not real or coming from the ground, right? So the saddest part is it's all probably common sense, but I really dig in the book to talk about sugar, refined flours, food coloring, alcohol in excess, coffee in excess. We really talk about the fact that those things in moderation are great. Overdoing it with salt. And then the one that everybody's really curious about is nightshades. And how nightshades can work for or against you.
I've known about nightshades since
my older cousin discovered
it.
Hold on, let's make sure people understand what nightshades are, because somewhere in the back of my head it was a caution from my parents. You know, if you see a plant that looks like this, it's deadly nightshade. Don't go anywhere near it.
Right.
Not that we ever really saw any anyway, but...
Right.
He's from the north of England. They don't grow anything there.
Nevertheless, that's what they told us. Nightshades include some foods that really people absolutely adore.
Right. And so the way to identify them is that they all have this little stem that looks like a little green hat that connects the fruit to the vegetable part of their stems. And so it's things that I love, too. Like Anne was saying, eggplant, bell peppers, tomatoes, standard potatoes, chilies. And so... You know, many people respond really well because those foods are loaded with vitamins A and C, but for people who react to them, they're reacting to this natural pesticide they have called glycoalkaloids, and that causes joint pain and arthritic symptoms in some. So,
well, and I have all the symptoms and the joint pain, but, you know, it doesn't make any difference. I was raised in a Sicilian kitchen, and I grew up on all that stuff.
Right.
Now, am I protected at all from it?
I can't speak truthfully to that because I don't know, but I don't think so. That's what's so fascinating. You know, we're all different, but my guess is probably not, unfortunately.
But if you find something that's in these different categories that doesn't agree with you, then the sensible thing and the effective thing to do is just stop.
Correct, or at least try it for a set amount of time. You know, I think you owe yourself a week to try something. And I had never really committed to taking something out completely for a while and then adding it back in. But when I finally took that step with gluten, it was so apparent what was going on and that was what was causing the majority of my pain. It became easy.
Now, it's really, here's a funny story for you from my growing up. Didn't like tomatoes growing up, or tomatoes growing up. And I think the reason that I didn't like them was because my grandfather, who I adored, didn't like tomatoes either. and of course, I was emulating his behavior.
Of course.
But I discovered much later from my mother that the reason that he didn't like tomatoes was the seeds used to get under his false teeth.
Oh, funny. I wouldn't like them either.
It had absolutely nothing to do with
the taste.
With the effect on his dietary, alimentary system, whatever you like to call it.
That's funny.
It simply had to do with the physical thing.
Yes.
And when I first started camping in the Northwest Highlands of Scotland, and you really were hungry when it came to meal times, and I was the youngest on this particular trekking party. If there was a tomato left over, I got it.
Yeah.
And I was hungry enough that I was happy to eat too.
That's so funny.
Now, you have a thing here, a four-step. What is it?
Oh, the four steps to improving your gut health, basically.
Yes, right.
Yeah, and that's where the doctor really came into play. I thought that this was so fascinating because, you know, the other thing I wanted to do was give access to people to what I had been learning. And, you know, there are so many doctors out there that can help you, but it can become cost prohibitive and all of those things. So Dr. Jacobs was amazing in that he kind of walks us through how to kind of clean up your digestive system in four steps, and they all happen to start with R. Remove. You know, remove the things that are causing, that you think are causing your pain or your inflammation, and then replace and supplement what's going on in your gut. So he talks about enzymes and how to kind of balance stomach acid, and then re-inoculating and restoring your gut health through healthy bacteria and active cultures, and then repairing, and then trying to get yourself back to normal with things like fish oil, zinc, you know, very easy things to find that can kind of bring you back to a better balance.
And I've tried fish oil and gave me acute indigestion.
Oh my gosh, you know, everybody handles that differently as well. So try different types and different amounts.
The amount thing is what I don't know. I keep asking people when they come up with these superfoods and all this stuff. I ask, well, how much of it do you have to actually consume to get the result that you're, nobody knows.
Yeah, and I think, you know what, in a perfect world, if I could do one thing, it would be to get all of these things that we need through our food, right? So I love where he explains in the ingredient sections about what are the types of fish you need to eat. And if you're eating those sources, you shouldn't have to take all of these other supplements that we've come to rely on. So there's a lot of education around that, and just teaching people to make an effort to really think about the foods they're putting in their bodies so they'll feel great.
It's interesting that there's an interesting area here. You can sort of supplement and supplement and supplement with a single item, if you like fish oil or vitamin E or vitamin XYZ or whatever it is. We've talked to people who have expressed the opinion that our approach is a bit naive if we think that just replacing something that would be in a food we should be eating with something artificial, that's going to solve the problem. In fact, what we really don't understand is there might be five or six ingredients, for example, in salmon.
Yes.
Which is a food everybody's hugely in favor of.
Right.
And taking a fish oil pill containing the things that salmon contain isn't necessarily the equivalent of eating a piece of salmon.
Exactly. And, you know, I think that's kind of the next step in all of these conversations around wellness. Like, we've learned so much and we understand what our bodies need to function well and feel great. But the whole idea of just being able to get it from your food is pretty awesome. You know, like,
yeah.
It's the way it used to be. And it would be great if we returned to that at some point.
You know, the thing I find disconcerting about all of this is, I can on face value see that all this is reasonable. Not everybody agrees with anything. You have one study that shows something, then you have another study that shows something else. You talk about dark chocolate. Now they're saying that it's not actually a healthy food like they started telling us. No, it's not like what they were proposing, some sort of miracle superfood. The thing was salt. Now they're saying that people don't have to pay that much attention to salt.
Oh, isn't it crazy? It is hard to keep up with what everybody believes. And
now, here are two interesting things, and I want to first of all tell you what I think they are, and then have you respond by saying, now maybe there are these two or three other things that we ought to be doing.
Okay.
So for reasons that go back decades, centuries in fact, people have been putting iodine in salt.
Right.
And the reason for this was that if you had a shortage of iodine in your diet, then you got serious dietary related disease
of the thyroid,
and that happened only in places where there wasn't any naturally occurring iodine in the groundwater. So
right.
There was areas in the country not far from where I live, for example, in a section called Derbyshire, there were lots and lots of non-ferrous metal mining communities, and for some reason the water that existed in that ground soil system didn't contain iodine, so people suffered from goiters and a number of other dietary-related diseases. Now, we probably haven't seen a goiter in the Western world for a century and a half.
Exactly.
But we still have iodine in our salt.
Right? I mean, we're slow to catch on. I think it was probably a great idea at the time. And then you forget that we've moved on, right?
Well, here's a second one. Fluoride in the water supply.
Yes, exactly.
For children's teeth. Again, now it's very rare that you would ever have any controversy about this, because every water system in the United States and probably in most of the Western world has fluoride added to the drinking water. Most people don't even know about it, and those who know about it either don't care or we just ignore them.
Right.
Now, are there two or three things like that in this dietary world that you've explored that you think would merit the same kind of massive public health campaign against, which is, I guess, what I'm talking about, iodine in salt and fluoride in drinking water designed to deal with?
Well, it's such a good question, and I think that what you're speaking about is that, you know, as we kind of changed our food system, things started to happen. I mean, the things you're referring to, like in times where people don't have access to great water or some of these things, and they're literally starving or they're malnutritioned, the idea of adding iodine or fluoride to something seems like a brilliant idea. But the great part about where we are in time right now is that we're catching back up to what works and what doesn't for us, you know, in this movement towards more sustainable agriculture, non-GMO processed foods, organic foods, and getting back to where we were is going to resolve some of those problems for us. And even what you're saying about iodine, it's funny because I do not cook with iodized salt. I just use kosher salt or sea salt.
Yeah.
And, well, we don't either, because we haven't seen a goiter in a century and a half.
Right. But it's so funny because I look at the foods that are good for us that contain natural iodine, and really it comes back to eating the things that we can grow or catch. And so, you know, all of these good fish that we talk about, salmon, sardines, shrimp, but yogurt, cow's milk, eggs, tuna, all of these things have iodine in them naturally. And so I love the idea of us getting back to eating real food and feeling great.
You know, there's another issue here. It depends a lot on your genetics, and that in part depends on where you're from. I mean, like the northern Europeans have always maintained milk in their diet.
Right.
Whereas, most other cultures don't, because I don't think anybody but babies need milk.
You are my new best friend. I'm laughing because you know all of this. And I think that that's what's so interesting to me, that you can be Northern European and process dairy so well and never have a problem with it. But it is truly our genetic makeup. And as we come from different parts of the world, we all respond differently to things. And most of us do best with whatever that kind of first diet was for us.
That's why I asked you about my nightshade.
Yeah, right? Like, you hope. I don't know. I hope for you that that's true.
Maybe they should put a warning label on tomatoes.
They cause harm.
Here's the funny thing. I want you to leave with a smile on your face. Because it occurs to me, having recently looked at a box of kosher salt, that it says in large letters, almost as large as those on the cigarette pack.
Yes.
What does it say?
This is dangerous to your health. It does not contain iodine, a necessary part of it.
They have to shout it from the rooftops.
It from the rooftops. Is it? No. Hey, maybe if you smoke cigarettes, you get iodine from that.
Yeah, right? Who knows?
Let's not ignore the fact that this is not only about health. Your recipes are really wonderful. Can you pick out a couple of recipes that you'd like to highlight?
I mean, oh my gosh,
there's so many.
Sure. Well, I think one of the things I loved about writing this book is that I didn't want to just solve this problem for people at dinner. I wanted to talk about the entire day and week. And so I'm really proud of the recipes that I've done for breakfast and snacks and things to learn how to make ahead. So, I mean, even just teaching people how to make vinaigrettes, and so that you can keep those around and be able to make yourself a salad or toss it with some grains or something during the week. I also laugh because I think people think healthy and they think quinoa and kale, which is not what I was trying to do, but the quinoa salad is so delicious and so is the kale salad. But then people are loving the curry that I do where it's a Thai red curry and you can add chicken, you could add tofu, even thinly sliced steak would be delicious. And then I went ahead and I did desserts because I feel like my kids are inundated always with tons of sugar, and I wanted to create a couple of things that are still a treat but better for you than what you'd find if you go out to the market or you go out to eat, you know. So they're really clean desserts. And
yeah, they are. Almond pistachio lemon cake sounds wonderful.
Oh, it's the best. It's so good. The fact that it's just naturally gluten-free and it's almond flour and pistachios, it's just delicious. So those are a couple of my favorites.
I found out from reading your book that what I have for breakfast turns out to be really close to Bip and Bop.
Oh, really? You do the same thing. I love putting a ton of things in a pan and seeing what comes out.
No, I can't remember why I did it for the first time, but I made...
You had leftover spicy lentils.
Oh, I had some leftover lentils, so I added something else to it and then started eating it for breakfast with boiled eggs.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
So now in our refrigerator at all times is a mixture of 50-50 lentils, sprouted lentils,
quinoa.
Sprouted quinoa, and I would have sprouted mung beans in there as well, except Whole Foods stopped stocking the brand I was buying, and the only mung beans I can find aren't sprouted, and sprouted's supposed to be healthy.
Yeah, I'm coming right over. You guys have everything I want in your refrigerator.
we actually have some new white beans named after
Marcella Hazan.
Oh, wow.
They're from Rancho Gordo.
They're
wonderful. You can lay hands on them. They're kind of scarce.
I can't tell you how much I love Rancho Gordo. We're going to be selling them here at Williams-Sonoma. I need to send you some. They're right here. They're a company.
We interviewed him the other week.
You did?
Oh, yeah.
That's great. Steve.
Send us some of your favorite. That would be great.
I would love to. Love to.
Well, anyhow, you have an interesting book, an interesting job, an interesting life. Aren't you riding on the high side, huh?
You're funny. It comes with hard work, right? When people are like, how'd you get to write a book on top of your great job? And I say, no one's going to outwork me. But I'm so passionate about what I do. So it's such a joy to see it come to life.
Well, the great thing about it is you got something out of it too, because you're feeling, you're feeling better.
Yeah, most definitely. It's just been such a blessing, truly.
Well, Amanda, maybe we'll see you sometime in San Francisco.
I sure hope so. Let's go out to eat together.
Great. We'll go to Local is the name of that place, right?
Yeah, great.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, here's something I would rather eat than all the chocolate eggs in the world. They're Parm Crisps from Kitchen Table Bakers, and I've been in love with these for ages. It's Parmesan cheese is what it is, and they've upped the ante, according to the co-founder, Barry Novick, because everything's natural now, so you can feel happy and honorable and what's the word I'm looking for?
I don't know. what's the word you're looking for?
Well, I don't know, but Barry tells me it's fine that I eat so many of these because it's good for me.
Yeah, it's good for you. The key thing is it's good for you, and it's especially good for you of carbs. Carbs are a problem for you. And I thought it was very interesting. I want to emphasize this because our good friend Lydia Bastia, which otherwise might be mad at us, these things, Barry didn't actually invent these.
No, they're fricos.
They're actually fricos from the Friuli, Venezia Giulia area of Italy, from where
Lydia
comes.
Yes.
And she frequently has them on her menu, and they are great there too. Back in 2009, we talked to somebody from Kitchen Table Bakers.
It was Seth. It was
Barry's son, Seth. Okay, I understand. But who had the remarkable idea of making a cracker, a snack food, out of old cheese, because I guess something about gluten didn't agree with you, or you just didn't like crackers made with wheat.
It was actually because I was on a low-carb diet.
There you go. And
there are no carbs in the product.
But you did have a hurdle to come, which was acquiring product. So you were buying up all the ground Parmesan cheese you could get at Costco on Long Island and then using that as your fuel. Now, I think you've come a fairly long way since then, but tell us more about the journey.
Well, the journey started because I put on a lot of weight. I was ill, and I needed to lose weight. So we found a recipe for Parmesan crisps. They call them Fricos, and we saw that it was zero carbs, and it really, you know, uses Parmesan cheese. So we went and bought cheese and made crisps for our friends, and basically overnight we were able to see that there was a business there.
So you actually modeled it after the Fricos, which are traditional cuisine in Venice, Julia.
Yeah, no question about it. We also realized that the way it should be made for properly is baked in on metal pans without frying. It's a baked product, and there are people out today that are, you know, trying to copy us, but they're using a microwave system, and you don't get the toasted notes on it or the caramelization as the product slowly bakes. And that's why we've been able to be around since 2003, believe it or not.
Oh, my God, that long, huh?
And yeah, we have a really great following. And
you better believe it. I've been in love with your product since I first tasted it. In fact, I told you, I don't actually go and buy it because I just sit down and eat the whole thing. Just as much as there is, I will consume.
Yeah, we got three packages this week. You ate them already.
I ate them already. I mean, I'm crazy about them.
And there really is nothing wrong with that.
I'd like to have some, but she's eaten them all.
We actually have hospitals buying our product for bariatric patients, because it's so
it's protein.
Yes, it's all protein.
Well, now, Barry Novick, you and your son Seth set up this company called Kitchen Table Bakers, and the product we're talking about is Parm Crisps. Now, we talked about what a long way you've come from a startup company. You're available all over the world, aren't you?
Well, we sell directly throughout North America. We found our product in Australia, and we've sold to Japan. We've sold to Korea. We've had product just about everywhere. We have distributors that are exporters that we drop ship the product in the U.S., and they have customers all over the world. In fact, we have a new customer hopefully coming on shortly for all of South America that is really in the food service business, believe it or not.
Wow.
Now,
the reason I'm back in touch with you is because you had a publicist send me a press release about a refreshing of your product. I guess I want you to tell me what that consisted of and why. Maybe why first and then what.
Why is because we really took a look at the market, and we saw that it was getting, that we needed a product that had more, we'll call it existential health benefits. The idea being that our product, we didn't want any of our product to have anything artificial in it, including the milk that the cows were producing. Most of the farms around the United States, anyway, provide the cows with an injection of growth hormone, which actually increases milk production at the expense of the cow. Growth hormone has been found to have many, many health risks. I even know for a fact I had an issue with a pituitary, and finding that the additional growth hormone affected all of my organs. It's been a long journey till we finally found out what was going on, but all along it was the additional growth hormone that was affecting me. Took a look at what was available, and human and artificial growth hormone is something that we didn't want to have in our product anymore from a personal point of view and from the benefit for all my consumers.
Yeah, because all whatever goes into the cow gets passed on to the consumer.
Right, and we made sure we took a look at that, and as we were doing, we wanted to make sure that all of the ingredients that went into the making of the cheese was GMO-free.
Oh, yeah.
So our product has all of the seeds and anything that went into the milk itself, the cheese is all GMO-free, although we're not portraying it that way. But that's basically what we looked at. But the main reason that we finally switched over was for the sake of the cows. Huh. The cows are healthier without the growth hormone, and we feel that it took a long time for me to really understand it. But now we've been very fortunate. We're working now with a new cheese manufacturer, one of the best in the country, and we have one of the finest vegetarian Parmesan cheeses available.
Yeah, now how did you skirt this whole issue with the, it's been a scandal about all the wood pulp fillers and particularly grated Parmesan cheese.
Well, originally, I think we talked about it in our original interview. We used to go to one of the big box stores and buy out all of their shredded cheese.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that was that every single batch was different.
Uh-huh.
Some had specks in it, some were dark, some were light.
Oh, no.
And by the time we realized that the only way that we could protect ourselves, because it happens, you have cheese that's sold, that it could be made from cheese from three different countries in some of these stores. So you have to be very careful what's in it.
Well,
so,
there are laws, there are regulations. But, I mean, until the scandal hit, I don't know. I mean, talking to Peter, he didn't know that there was an allowable amount of this wood pulp in Parmesan cheese. I mean, what is the limit?
As far as we're concerned, zero.
Okay.
We found that it just really created an issue when you're baking a product and you want it to come out fine. The cellulose or the anti-caking agents many of the companies use create an issue in terms of what it really is.
Now, to begin with, though, you were buying cheese already grated. Now you're buying whole wheels of cheese and grating them yourself?
Well, that's what happened. We decided that there was no way we could continue doing that, so we actually went to the University of Wisconsin, the Center for Dairy Research,
and we
bought different cheeses, and we sent it to them to find out why some worked and some didn't.
Huh.
And believe it or not, baking cheese is more of a science project than it is as a bakery issue. You've got to have the pH at a certain level. You've got to have the different galactose levels. The salt content, everything affects how a product is made. And again, we even showed our previous supplier what was involved. We have letters and notes and conference calls with the CDR showing them what works and what doesn't. So we finally landed on a specification, and we tested the product vigorously every time it came in. We returned more product than we kept half the time, and we bought all the grading equipment, and we graded the product, and we still do that today. We take we were using blocks in the past, and now we've found an incredibly delicious product, but it's made the old-fashioned way, and it's an award-winning product, and now we grade it ourselves, so we have total control over everything from the time, you know, it's opened up to the time that it's put on the pans.
You've actually sort of launched your company more than once, haven't you?
Oh, boy. We've actually had some real issues from time to time. Originally, we started out as the no-carb kitchen.
Uh-huh.
And was doing beautifully until Dr. Atkins died. And anything that said no carb was taken off the shelves. Nobody would touch any. It was really a very trying time for us. But we, as a family, we were making it in our kitchen at the time.
Still. Uh-huh.
at the very beginning.
Yeah.
We sat around and we decided that we had a great product and that we should repackage ourselves, rebrand ourselves. And as we're sitting around the table, we said, why don't we just call ourselves the Kitchen Table Bakers? Because that's where families live, around that kitchen table. Decisions are made. Good things happen. It was just a really warm feeling about the name. So we wrapped up a couple of packages for ourselves, went to the fancy food show, and believe it or not, we found a distributor, gourmet distributor, who loved our product and had a customer that wanted it. And overnight, we were elegant.
There you go. It's an amazing story. This is a made in America story with a fine, well, upstanding American family. And
well, we even had some. It didn't stop there. We ended up going to a co-packer when it finally got a little too big for us, who we were with for a number of years. And one night, one of my trucks came in to deliver something, and there were chains on the door.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And it turned out that the co-packer got evicted and didn't tell us he was having financial problems.
Oh, no.
So we ended up with the lawyers. We ended up going in and pulling out all of our stuff, and we had a backup who we went to in another state and drove everything up. We filled up a 53-foot semi with all of our equipment, all of our pans, and all the cheese.
Jeez.
And pulled up and said, here we are. Can you do this for us? So we had a bump, a couple of months, and then came Hurricane Irene, and then came Hurricane Sandy.
Oh, yeah.
And, it was just like one after another. And over time, as we grew, we decided we needed more control over the whole process. You know, co-packers are great, but it's not their product.
Uh-huh.
So we had all sorts of equipment designed and made. We hired a tremendous consultant who used to be the vice president for R&D for Pepperidge Farm for 14 years. He's the guy that put the smile on the goldfish. He was their production person. Yeah, that's his name. A lovely man, Gary Israel.
Uh-huh.
And he took our hand and spoon-fed us what we needed to do, production and quality control, and you name it. He helped design special equipment for us. And, we just couldn't get the co-packer to do everything that we wanted. And we said, it's time. So it took a year for us to learn how to make it. After 3 years with this company, we bought our own ovens. We put them in, our own depositors, our own, just you name it. We developed it. And that's one of the good things about a co-packer. It's a test kitchen. It's a laboratory. And we moved this past summer, and now the production is unlimited. We went from making 200 cases a day to 800 cases a day.
Wow.
With the same amount of people at a fraction of the cost.
Well, you've had a long, sharp learning curve, I must say. Where can people get these?
Oh, right now we're in all of the Kroger stores around the United States and all the Murray Cheese pavilions.
Okay.
And the Cut and Wraps. We're in Fresh Market. We're in all the Super Walmarts.
Yeah, and do you have a locator on your website for people to find where they can get it?
For the most part, that's one of the issues. We sell through distributors, and distributors don't always tell you where everything is. So if they call us, we pretty much know where they are, and we can tell them. Our phone number and names on every package. We do have a finder, and about 80% effective, but we're growing every day. We're picking up one chain after another.
Oh, wow.
And it's just... We're replacing the competition that copied us, the one that's microwaving the product.
Yeah.
We are the only ones that have RBST-free, that's the artificial growth hormone, and we're the only ones that really work also, even though we're a gourmet product, we work with hospitals, we work with nutritionists, we're on very specific diet plans for kids with epilepsy, with people that have other major illnesses, because we really cross the T's and dot the I's on our product.
And not only that, listeners, but these Parm crisps are singularly delicious. Barry, it's so good talking to you again, and you keep up the good work because I love your product.
Well, we love you also, and I really do appreciate this opportunity. And if there's anything any of the listeners want to know, parmcrisp.com.
Parmcrisp.com, okay.
And the best part is that there's a phone number. They can call me, and I personally answer a lot of the phone calls and talk to all the consumers.
We are
love
people
to hear from
person.
Them.
I mean, you like people. That's clear.
I love people. It's a very rewarding thing that we've accomplished.
Yeah. Well, and we'll continue to accomplish, I'm sure. Barry, again, thank you. Hello to Seth, and continued success.
Thank you so much again. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And for our final segment, I want to say that encountering philosophers who are so involved with food and wine always tickles me. And our latest one, Dwight Furrow, he knows what he's doing. He knows how to get his class attention. He knows how to write a book that people love to read. His book is American Foodie, Taste, Art, and the Cultural Revolution. Listen to his perspective on food. Dwight Furrow is a professor of philosophy at San Diego Mesa College. He specializes in the philosophy of food and wine, aesthetics, and ethics. And I know other people who do this, so I don't think it's as odd as some people might think it is. It's tied also to your interest in wine, and you really have good credentials in that, too. You have advanced level certification from the Wine and Spirits Educational Trust. So you're sort of a Renaissance man, Dwight.
I suppose, but there was a close connection between wine and food. It's all about taste and flavor and so on. So that part of it's pretty well integrated. But
well, your
the,
book
philosophy
is
part.
Your book is called American Foodie: Taste, Art, and the Cultural Revolution, which means that you're presenting a case for explaining why all of a sudden our involvement with food is so all-consuming. First off the bat, everybody's trying to find a word replacement for foodie. Did you think of one?
I didn't. That's why I used the word foodie. I don't really like the term very much, but I racked my brain and looked all over for alternatives, and it's really the word that has kind of stuck. Afraid we're stuck with it.
Uh-huh. Now, you trace through the history of American. I mean, it is all about us Americans. You trace through the history of our involvement with food and the development of the celebrity chefs and so on. And we get that from a number of different sources. We've had that. David Camp did it. We did a whole bunch of other things with it. Now, what is new about your book is that you separate out the fact that it is a cultural phenomenon, as opposed to just a natural evolution, and also that it's sort of a revolution. I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, I mean, I think that for most of our history, as a lot of these other sources that you mentioned have pointed out, Americans were not all that concerned with high-quality food. In the past, it's really been about convenience and low cost and large quantities. And I think in the last, 20 to 30 years, we've all of a sudden become very, very interested in the quality of our food. And so I think that constitutes a revolution. It's really a change in our approach to food. And so I try to explain why that change has taken place now at this point in our history.
And why is that?
Well, I think that most of us lead lives that are hectic and competitive. The values of the workplace have infiltrated all dimensions of life, including the home. And I think that food and wine, the culture of the table in general, resist this corporate world because when we eat thoughtfully, we put pleasure before production and care before commerce. So I think the food revolution is responding to our need for face-to-face authentic experiences and creative expression. More and more people have discovered the need for these experiences, and so we have this explosion of interest in food and beverages.
Now, is this sort of like striking off into a new dimension of the world of philosophy?
Oh, it certainly is, yeah. I mean, if you look in the history of philosophy, you find very, very few references to food and no sustained discussion of them, which is kind of odd. It always struck me as odd because food is so important in our lives, and philosophers are supposed to be answering the question how to live. So it always struck me as being peculiar that we didn't talk more about these sort of mundane, everyday parts of life. So recently, the philosophy of food and wine has become a little bit more prominent. There are some other books out there and some other people talking about it. So I think it's a kind of an important development, although it's still rather unusual to hear discussions of the philosophy of food.
Now, when I was at Cambridge studying geography back 1,000 years ago, it seems like we had two of our final exam papers for our degree were on the subject of the evolution and significance of geographical thought, which seems rather extreme. I must confess, even when I went to the classes on those subjects, I really wasn't sure. I was convinced there was such a thing. And I would tend to even think that perhaps no more is there such a thing as a philosophy of food, but obviously I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a very minor subfield at this point. But I think philosophers are finding more and more to say about it. Of course, it's to my mind, it's connected to aesthetics because we are concerned now with the quality of food and so on. So I think that a lot of the categories we've used to talk about painting and music and so on can also be used to discuss food in a more fruitful way. So I think there's a lot there to explore, even though it's a rather new discipline.
Well, you explained that you thought it was actually a class thing about food. And I would argue that it's really a class thing about aesthetics. I mean, everything about it, painting and music. And I mean, it wasn't like what you had in everyday blue-collar society.
No, that's true. I mean, I think that especially the fine arts have always been kind of reserved for people who had the resources to pursue them and so on. And that does make food a little bit different because, of course, food is an everyday occurrence for us.
And you need it.
So you've got this kind of tension between food that's created for its artistic merit and food that's more of an everyday thing. But I think that the food that the great chefs are creating can be an inspiration to home cooks to improve their cooking. So I think there's a kind of continuity there. But I do agree that food is a little different than the fine arts because it is something that we're concerned with every day, several times a day.
Now, I wanted to come back to that subject because you talk about that subject in a slightly different way later in the book. But I want to go back to thinking about something else which you sort of weave in there, but you don't think it explains everything, and that's food as a social fabric, where food eaten by the family unit together, often a very large family unit together, is in fact a very important part of social fabric in much of the rest of the world, not quite so much here in the United States.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think this is something we're discovering, how important food is. Of course, we're challenged because we're such a mobile society. We're always on the run. And that makes the kind of large get-togethers that some of the other European countries have almost a weekly basis. That makes it difficult for us, I think. So the American context is a little bit different. But, yeah, I quite agree that food is just central to the whole idea of civilized life. We really organize our time around getting food and consuming it. It plays a central role in almost all of our social relationships and so on. So I think that's a really important dimension of food. I think inherently food creates a sense of community, and I think that's one thing that we don't have that much of in the United States, and I think that's another reason why food has become so popular, because it does create the sense of community. It gets us to slow down and savor the moment and enjoy the people that we're sharing food with.
We have a friend who's an anthropologist who has been studying the same teeny village in Japan for something like 40 years or more, actually. And he said that one of the most important developments in that village's society was the advent of McDonald's. Why?
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I know. Why?
Because
it was an opportunity, again, for the family to get together and commune over food, which they had drifted away from.
Yes, so instead of cooking, if you like, sushi at home or ramen noodles at home, the whole family together would all go to McDonald's.
Oh, that's interesting.
It is interesting because it has nothing to do with the quality of the food.
Right, right, yeah. Well, we do love differences. We do love, with our food preferences, especially once you get into food a little bit, is to always find something new, something different, something that that's exotic. And I suppose for them, McDonald's cuisine is just pretty exotic, quite different.
Right.
So it's a kind of a different sort of adventure for them than it is for us.
You know, you mentioned molecular gastronomy. In passing, it goes further. One of the primary adopters of that was Hester Blumenthal, the Fat Duck in Bray, England. Do you know his work?
Well, yes, I do.
Okay, well, his latest experimentation and exploration is now called neurogastronomy. Do you know about that?
Yes, I mean, in fact, I think there's a book called that. The attempt is to try to understand the underlying neurophysiology of our taste preferences and so on. Yeah.
And he's trying to recreate these experiences, controlling the light, the sound, the smell, the everything. I mean, when is it enough? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I mean, that's the thing, when food becomes an art, which I think it has, at least for people like Heston Blumenthal and Jose Andreas and so on, there really aren't any limits. The whole idea is to explore something new and something fascinating. I mean, I think that, we're really discovering how much the ambient environment influences our perceptions of what we're eating, and I think that's what he's exploring, is how that ambient environment influences our taste preferences and so on. So, I mean, all of this stuff, of course, is outside the realm of what we can do every day, but it is interesting, and it's exploring taste in a way that we never thought of before. So, I find it fascinating and interesting in the same way I find avant-garde art interesting. It's not for everyday personal enjoyment, but it's just a further exploration of our sensory experience.
No, it's funny. You observe us there, how society has changed, and it seems as though the only place where people eat dinner together every Sunday is a New York City based cop show called Blue Bloods.
Yeah.
but in this house, filled with only two people who've been married to each other for 40 some years, we sit down to dinner every night. And people think that's really strange.
Especially the younger generation. Our kids don't.
Well, they do when we go there, but they say that's the only time they do. But I want to go down another pathway which you explored, and I don't think I got through all the exploration of it, and that's comparing a piece of artwork versus a piece of food, if you like, when it comes to what it's like, and you make the distinction that if you're looking at a painting by Rembrandt, Rembrandt created it. There isn't another one. You're looking at the only existence of it, aside from all the Van Meegeren fakes that were out there. But in the case of food, what is happening is somebody is creating a recipe that somebody created many, many, many times before. And then you say, well, how do I assess them to be the same thing? Do I have the same philosophy about food as I do about Edward Munch's the Scream, for example?
It's the issue of the craft versus art. That's what he's talking to you about.
Yeah, so there are several points in the book where I do discuss this issue, sometimes in connection to the issue of authenticity, but the discussion of Munch there is an attempt to show that food can have the kind of meaning that works of art can have. And, that's been the main bone of contention. Many people claim that food can't be art because it doesn't have meaning. Flavors are just flavors and we enjoy them, but beyond that, they don't give us any insight into anything. And so what I'm arguing there in the book is that if we think of dishes as representations of food traditions, then what the flavors are about are the sensibility of a people, the sensibility of a culture, and that every new dish that comes out is commenting on it in a way that a new painting is commenting on the history of art. So I think that there's really no distinction between the kinds of meanings that you get from painting or music and the kinds of meanings you can get from food. I think there are sharp parallels to draw there if we focus on the right thing. And I think focusing on the tradition that the food emerges from seeing the food as being about that tradition, that's very important, I think.
You have another observation about a Picasso painting and a dish, I guess. Was it a dish by Grant Achatz?
Yes, I think so.
And you explain there that you see quite a lot of similarity in the philosophy that lies behind what's going on in both cases.
Yeah, the dish by Grant Achatz was a dish. The one I had in mind in particular was this. It was meant to illustrate or put us in mind of roasting marshmallows on the fire. It was a sweet potato that was charred and then served with homemade marshmallows and so on. And it was a very elaborate dish, and it was made to put us in mind of roasting marshmallows around a campfire as a child.
And burning leaves, except the funny thing is that because he's in Chicago, he doesn't understand that on the East Coast we can't burn leaves in the fall.
That's right.
So that takes us back to individual experiences, right?
Right. So just the way that Picasso's Weeping Woman was the example I used puts us in mind of a grief-stricken person. The Achatz dish puts us in mind of experiences we've had around the campfire. So the meaning is very similar.
You devote quite a number of pages then to this philosophy of food, which I guess you've examined probably more deeply than most people, although you do quote some of your colleagues and other authorities on the way through. But when you got to the end, what did you conclude that you think would be illustrative of what a future interaction with food is going to look like?
Well, I guess the question is, will this interest in food sustain itself? I really emphasize that this is about, the interest in food is really about freshness of local ingredients using local sources. It's about not getting caught up in the food industry and allowing them to impose their tastes on us and so on. So it's really about trying to avoid the homogenization we find in the fast food market where everything really basically tastes the same. So it's really, I think the heart of the food revolution is focusing on the local community, the uniqueness of local tastes and so on. So the question I've was raising at the end there is whether this can sustain itself. And so I posed the hypothesis that we really need to get more into this whole process of mindful eating because we can, through mindful eating, we can develop our own personal taste preferences that have nothing to do with what the food industry tries to impose on us. And so I'm hoping that we continue to go in this direction of really focusing on the local, because I think that's at the heart of the food revolution, and focusing on avoiding the kind of standardization that we see in the rest of society.
It's kind of not a new revolution. I mean, we used to always eat locally because that's the only choice we had.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and but now they're working on, well, they can't even get the requirement for a GMO labeling on a food product, or they can't get producers to label meat from cloned animals listed, and now they're working on 3D printers for food that carry it a step further, and not just sugar, but for all kinds of foods, and actually cook the food, bake it.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know when the turning point will be. Do you have any idea, Dwight?
Well, I don't really have a crystal ball, so it's hard to know how this is going to go, but it seems to me all of that is just antithetical to what the food revolution is about. I mean, it's really about us making our own food. It's about taking control of our taste. It's about learning to cook and cook well, because that's something we can do for ourselves and something that employs all of our capacity. I'm hoping that even as the food industry continues to create these sort of standardized manufactured products, can move away from that as much as possible and have more control over our taste.
That's a good ideal to aim for, that's for sure.
Here's what I'm worried about. In conclusion, and I'm going to suggest where you might write your next philosophical book if you're interested. I wonder, and worries about the use of 3D printers to create food items. What I'm worried about is the use of 3D printers to produce Rembrandts and Picassos.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Yeah, but I think we demand, we really appreciate the original, and we still do, and I think that's just part of our nature.
But what would happen if you couldn't tell?
Well, we often can't tell, but even when you can't tell, we still value the original, because the original is the,
right.
That's the accomplishment, you know.
Yes,
so.
It's so funny, there's an art museum in an out-of-the-way, not well-known art museum in London called the Wallace Collection. And I think they at one time thought they had 15 Rembrandts. They had them all studied, and now they have 6.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, dear.
It's been a pleasure, Dwight, and we hope things are well in San Diego. They usually are. The sun is undoubtedly shining, and the vegetables are growing, and all's well in the world.
It's like that today, for sure, yes.
Mm. Well, thanks, and good luck, Dwight.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it.
Bye-bye.
So there you have it, a food philosophy to finish off today's program. How deep is that?
Oh, yeah.
but any event, to put it on a lighter note, we hope that you and the Easter Bunny have a wonderful time today, and that you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And until then,
bye-bye.